It's Charles Barkley here with Wayfair. And let me tell you, game day is serious business at my house. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grill accessories, Wayfair's got it all. And it shows up fast. I'm talking fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game. And head to Wayfair.com to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Messi fans, Lowe's Messi Halftime Event hits July 19th. That's coming up fast, so now's a really good time to become a Mylo's Rewards or a Mylo's Pro Rewards member. Join for free and get access to exclusive Messi moments and epic surprises. Let's just say halftime's looking different this year. Make sure to follow Lowe's on TikTok and tune in to the Lowe's Messi Halftime Event on July 19th. Members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
This summer, I'm taking a new approach to styling the smallest spaces in my house with help from Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has the small space solutions that America's waited 250 years for, like retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, dinner party ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish, spacious, bobopedic sofas, and feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back in even the smallest rooms. Plus, I know that Bob's styles are backed by thousands of real five-star customer reviews, so I can trust that the furniture that I'm getting is not just affordable, but built to last. And the best part? Bob's furniture ships fast, so I can enjoy my new styles all summer long. So when you're ready to ditch the furniture you're not excited about for the latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome to the broadcast on this Sunday, June 14th, 2026. I'm Rob Jerisline. Appreciate you joining me for the next 1 hour talking outdoor topics here in Minnesota. Two great guests I'm excited to chat with later today. We'll have Steve McComas with us in about 15 minutes. He's the Lake Detective. If you've ever got a question for him, just email him, lakedetective@gmail.com. Then a very special guest, Curtis DeBerg, who joined me on the program 2-3 years ago. He's a big Ernest Hemingway fan. He's traveled the world retracing Hemingway's steps. He's originally from the upper Midwest, Iowa, and then he did spend some time in Minnesota, too. He's a big Minnesota Twins fan, so he must like WCCO. But he found an inscribed copy of a book that Ernest Hemingway signed down in Rochester and eventually took it to Sweden. He'll tell you why when he joins us here at the bottom of the hour. Tons of news topics, as usual, here affecting the outdoors. The big one is the electronic licensing system. Saw its official kickoff this past Tuesday, June 9th. We've been discussing that for a number of weeks here on WCCO Outdoors. Kelly Straka joined us last weekend. We talked about the big kickoff. The launch went pretty well, relatively seamless. I didn't hear of any new problems with it late this past week. Tuesday morning, however, I tried to use the app version of the new system myself on my iPhone, and I could not. They did have a little bit of a delay with Apple not approving the app version of the new system for the iOS platform as of early Tuesday morning, which was the official kickoff date. It's my understanding that they submitted the app to both Google and Apple the previous week, which feels to me like cutting it a little close, given how long things can sometimes take to get approved. But anyway, Google approved it immediately, and Apple had not approved that new app by midnight this past Tuesday when they launched the system officially. Now, I was in touch with a number of people from DNR Tuesday morning, and by 11 o'clock, they said Apple had approved it, and by 2 o'clock, you could download the app on your iPhone. I didn't get around to trying it until Tuesday evening. You know, there were a number of steps to kind of get it going. It took some patience. You know, there were security protocols. You know, that's good that you have to do some due diligence. You know, you either need a code emailed to you or texted to you, or you need to use an authenticator code to get into the system, to log into the system the first time. And that's all good, right? This is all private information. You don't want it to be easy for anyone else to access. So I'm glad those security protocols are in place. But it took a little patience maybe to get it going the first time. You know, I think I had to type in my driver's license number, you know, and I had to create a username, password, all that good stuff. But once you're in, I found it pretty easy to buy a license. I bought my wild rice license for later this summer so I can go wild ricing again. And of course, the app is very easy to download from the Apple Store. It just, like I say, takes a little bit to log in. And then you can go back to the app anytime, click it, and it recognizes me. And there's a quick list of my licenses. It's real easy to just tap on those licenses. If a conservation officer should happen to demand to see my wild rice license, there's even a QR code. I don't know. Maybe COs can just scan that code and then verify it. But it's on your phone now, which is incredibly handy, right? Because we're all running around with smartphones all the time. So I would give the DNR probably a solid B+ for the launch. I think it went pretty well. There was that short delay Tuesday morning, but everybody can access it now on Android, iPhone, smartphones, or just go to mndnr.gov and you can log into the system there. The DNR is taking feedback on it. They'll make refinements as citizens, you know, adopt the new system. And they're saying phase two of the launch will happen later and will involve the addition of recreational vehicles and watercraft titling and registration. They'll have that module added to the system. For now, titling and registration process is the same. It works the same on the old legacy system. You know, one thing, just kind of checking this out, I think it would be nice if the app had an added security step where, you know, it needed facial recognition to open it. Maybe that's there and I just haven't figured out how to do it yet. But I like, because when you open that app, all your information is right there. If someone were able to get a hold of your phone and crack your overall, you know, security code to open your phone. I know there's already a couple levels of security there, but I think I'd like that facial recognition in there too. I'm told there's also ways to link, like your children's accounts to your own. I haven't done that yet. I only have one kid under age 18 still. But I will probably link her account to mine. She likes to go turkey hunting, so we'll get her into the system too here soon. I haven't heard any real negative feedback. We had some chatter about it on our Facebook page at Outdoor News. And you get a lot of real negative comments on almost everything. And, you know, I didn't see anybody go ballistic. You know, I saw a few people saying, I like the old system better. And some people grousing on Tuesday that they couldn't find it on the App Store. I'm sure they found it by the end of the day. But I haven't heard an overwhelming backlash to it, which, you know, usually anytime there's any change, that's what you hear. So I think that's a great sign for the DNR. And I know they worked hard for many years putting this system together. And knowing how hard it is to implement new software, I think the agency deserves some credit for getting this done. So I encourage everyone to check it out themselves, learn to use it maybe this summer before you buy your hunting tag so you don't get surprised by it in August and September. With that, let's grab a break. We will have the Lake Detective with us when we return. You're listening to WCCO Outdoors.
It's Charles Barkley here with Wayfair. And let me tell you, game day is serious business at my house. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grill accessories, Wayfair's got it all. And it shows up fast. I'm talking fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game. And head to Wayfair.com to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Messy fans, Lowe's Messy Halftime Event hits July 19th. That's coming up fast, so now's a really good time to become a MyLowe's Rewards or a MyLowe's Pro Rewards member. Join for free and get access to exclusive Messy moments and epic surprises. Let's just say halftime's looking different this year. Make sure to follow Lowe's on TikTok and tune in to the Lowe's Messy Halftime Event on July 19th. Members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
This summer, I'm shopping the small space solutions that America waited 250 years for at Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has everything from retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, party-ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish and space-conscious Bobopedic sofas to feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back all summer long. So, when you're ready to snag latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Identity Refreshing!
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk A3O. Welcome back to the broadcast. On this Sunday, June 14th, I'm Rob Driesline. We're going to devote most of this segment talking about lakes and lake health and lake biology with our friend Steve McComas, the lake detective. Before we jump into that, quick news item related to fisheries and lakes. Brad Parsons, the DNR section chief of fisheries for the past 8 years, announced he's going to be retiring early this fall, I think in September. The DNR has begun a search for his replacement. If you're interested in applying, I guess you can go to LinkedIn or whatever. But I think pretty highly of Brad. He's been on this show before. I think he's been a real stable leader there in fisheries over the years. He's got a lot of research background. And done a fine job. He will be a tough guy to replace. So happy retirement to Brad Parsons. We'll probably get him on sometime this summer before he officially says sayonara. Now let's keep the subject focused on lakes. Once a year, our friend Steve McComas calls into the broadcast. He's the lake detective. Blue Water Science is his business out of St. Paul. He's out there helping folks improve the quality of their lakes, improve water quality around the state. He's been at it for many years, and it's good to see Steve again. Steve, how are you doing?
Hey, Rob, good day. 100%. All systems are go on my end.
We're into June already. How did the lakes come through this past winter? Were there any anomalies? Was it a pretty normal winter? Seemed like we had an earlier than normal ice out. Then fairly cool April and early May, and now into the heat. Seemed like an average year for lakes, or is nothing average anymore?
So it's all relative, but lake levels are about constant, so they're not too high, not too low, though there's always those outliers. And the snowpack, is about close to normal. Ice out, I would say we came into spring under pretty much normal conditions, not a lot of flooding and things. However, you're right about the cool temperatures, but in April we did have a week or so of really warm temps. And that seemed to boost some of the early growth of some of these invasive species like curly-leaf pondweed. And then we kind of settled back down. So it's been, I guess you could call it, a mixed bag.
Yeah, I think coming out of winter, we all thought water levels were going to be incredibly low. Then, we've had a pretty decent, I would even go so far as to call it a normal spring in terms of moisture, thus far into about the first half of June. I was fishing on the Mississippi River last weekend. My dad is always real paranoid about going out on the river based on water levels. And it was about as average can get, I thought, down on Pool 5A where we were fishing.
Yep. I see the same things on lakes. There's going to be a few lakes that may be a tad lower than usual and a few lakes a little bit of high water. But for the most part, most of them are right about where they typically should be in a normal condition.
Now, it finally got cool here this weekend, it got normal here this weekend after 2 weeks of pretty above average muggy temperatures and a fair amount of moisture to go with that. Have you seen algae blooms or any other negatives that we associate with some of our lakes kick in earlier because of that heat?
Not really. And I think what happened is because we had a snowpack that was moderate. And so we didn't bring in a lot of nutrients, which sometimes will fuel algae blooms early in the year. So what happened is that at the warm temperatures, the aquatic plants kicked in. And when plants get the first head start, typically they will kind of subdue the algae. And so we have some nice clear water conditions in a lot of lakes right now. Of course, there's always those outliers. There are some algae blooms out there and some floating filamentous algae on top. But for the most part, I'm seeing a lot of nice clear water lakes.
And our aquatic invasive species, you brought those up earlier. There's a lot of them here in Minnesota. I see we just got a press release from the Minnesota DNR saying that Little Boy Lake up in Cass County, north central Minnesota, has an infestation of zebra mussels. That's getting pretty far north for zebes. They're across a good swath of the state. What do you make of zebes? Have they kind of stabilized a little bit in most areas, but they're still infiltrating new places, aren't they?
That's right, Rob. And the problem with zebra mussels is that unlike other invasive species, like if you're a plant, well, then you can only be transported from one lake to another. If you're a milfoil, you have to have a milfoil plant to be transferred to the next lake. With zebra mussels, though, they can attach to any plant species. And so when that trailer goes into the next lake with zebra mussels, I mean, it could be on a variety of species. They are more apt to be spread around from that angle. However, a lot of our zebra mussel lakes, we're starting to plateau a little bit in terms of the frequency of new infestations per year. Unfortunately, we have a lot of lakes with zebra mussels right now. Well,
and that's why the frequency is going down, right? Because so many are already infested. Steve, you spend a fair amount of time scuba diving, zipping around the bottom of our lakes.
Oh, yeah.
How are fish populations doing? I've talked a lot about forward-facing sonar and some of my concerns about the pressure that's putting on our fisheries, especially big fish. Do you think fish populations are hanging in out there? When you're swimming around, what's your general gut feel about fish populations? We had a report here in Outdoor News and other media last week that there's a research study that says anglers are taking more than twice as many fish as the DNR's previous estimate. I don't know if you saw that, if you bought into that research, if you think that was a solid study with solid data. I guess, again, what I'm driving at here is how do you think fish populations are doing in this state where fishing is so important?
I think the panfish are doing okay, even though we've been harvesting them, and maybe we've been harvesting more than what's been recorded. Those creel senses are good, but they don't tell the whole story all the time. Well, I am seeing a lot of healthy panfish populations in a number of lakes, and then along with that there will be some predators following them around. So largemouth bass and bluegills and the panfish seem to be holding their own, and panfish, I would think, I'm seeing even maybe a little bit higher frequency than average. I know I was out on a lake yesterday, Lake Sylvia, up in Wright County. There was 14 boats in the access on a Tuesday morning, all going for panfish. So the panfish bite is on right now, it sounds like.
Well, heat is good, right? I mean, it's good in some ways, it's bad in others. But I mean, you know, these warm water lakes, that a longer growing season, more fertile, that's good for growing bigger fish. I mean, that's why you find the biggest bass down south and big slab crappies down south too, compared to what we have up here. What about some of our bigger game fish species, the sport fish, the predators, the walleyes, the pike? They're pretty easy to target with this forward-facing sonar, Steve.
Boy, they can, yes. That live scope is something else. However, it still does, I mean, they still have to bite. But that will certainly help you put you on some fish. But I'm talking to some anglers, too, coming off a lake saying, hey, we were bouncing that jig right off, you know, their snouts, and they still weren't biting. So it does give you an advantage to a point, but you still don't always automatically get them in the boat, I guess.
You think big pike and walleye populations are hanging in there? I mean, we're talking about lowering, not talking about, the DNR is very serious about lowering the walleye limit from 6 to 4. You think that's a good idea?
I think it's okay. I think for the most part, most anglers aren't getting 6 walleyes at an outing as well. And going to 4 would make it a little bit easier. And we can't hardly put restrictions on the new technology. I mean, we can, but that's a slippery slope. And so with the new advances, sometimes we'll have to manipulate other aspects to kind of even the playing field, so to speak, and keep our fish populations healthy.
You're listening to WCCO Outdoors. We're chatting with Steve McComas, the lake detective. If you ever have a question for Steve, shoot him an email, lakedetective@gmail.com. And he'll write about it in a future column of Outdoor News, or maybe we'll broach the topic here on the radio show. Steve, we had a fish kill in Lake Coma, got some headlines. 10,000 fish. That's pretty healthy fish kill. I think a lot of people associate fish kills with winter kill. To see one fairly early in the summer, what's going on there?
Boy, it sounded like it was a low dissolved oxygen situation. What happens is that during the day, when you have a little bit of an algae bloom in some of these shallow, fertile lakes, you know, the algae are really cooking, the warm temperatures enhance their metabolism. So during the day, they are photosynthesizing, and as they grow, now photosynthesis, you put out oxygen. However, at nighttime, all the algae are using oxygen because now they're metabolizing the sugars they made from photosynthesis. They could be consuming oxygen and actually lowering the oxygen at night. And that's where we get the low DO levels. And in a shallow lake, they can consume, and we can go right to zero in some cases under the right exact conditions. Also, at this time of the year, fish are just coming off their spawn. They've been stressed out because they put so much energy into their spawning activities and all those processes. They're more vulnerable to a low dissolved oxygen and even picking up some bacterial infections as well. That Culminaris is a bacteria that will also knock down some crappies and panfish this time of the year.
It's a shallow lake, and an urban area can get real warm really fast, can it? Then I suppose that's bacterial.
That's right. Compared to a deeper lake, more volume, more water.
Before we go, Steve, you wrote a column recently for Outdoor News. You were talking about in the past you'd worked on a research team investigating the feeding habits of the St. Peter's fish in the Sea of Galilee in Israel. One thing that jumped out at me about that was You said the Sea of Galilee is about the size of Lake Vermilion. You know, just one of our kind of, you know, average, not average. I mean, Vermilion's a big lake, but it just reminded me how blessed we are to have so much great fishing water here in Minnesota.
That's right. That's right. And of course, that lake over there, which is about 45,000 acres with size of Vermilion, but because lakes are fairly rare in that part of the world, I mean, they call it a sea. And of course, it's all fresh water. It's a big freshwater lake. The locals there call it Lake Kinneret. But St. Peter's fish is basically just a tilapia. And that is the fish that was around. You know, there's some historical significance associated with St. Peter's fish as well.
Are they native in that lake?
A long time ago, you know, millennia ago is okay. When tilapia came in there. So, yeah, that part of the world, when you're talking something that is native or non-native, I mean, it can go back a long, long time. So they were probably introduced.
And there was a push there to protect the tilapia and restrict commercial fishing because of what was happening with the algae balance. Is that right?
Yes, right. When people were looking, you know, fishermen, it's a commercial fishery there, and they get it for restaurants. When they were filleting the tilapia or St. Peter's fish, they were finding there was algae in their stomach. And they thought, oh, my goodness, these fish must be eating the algae in the Sea of Galilee. And we would like to protect the fish so that there's more fish eating the algae to improve, you know, water quality. Well, that's what our research team was investigating. It turns out that the zooplankton were eating the algae and the fish were eating the zooplankton. Now, the zooplankton would dissolve in their stomach, but these plates, these dinoflagellate algal plates, did not dissolve. So what was left was what appeared to be them eating algae when, in fact, they were eating zooplankton. Zooplankton were key for controlling the algae. So we actually came back and said, no, go ahead, fish the tilapia. You can keep your commercial fishery going. And because as the fish numbers go down, the zooplankton numbers go up. With more grazing on the algae, actually it would enhance the water quality. So that was kind of a win-win for everybody. The fishermen were happy. The restaurant visitors were happy as well.
It's nice when some research wraps up like that, a positive for everybody.
Right.
A little drama over there in Israel on the Sea of Galilee. I'm glad you were over there to help figure that out, Steve. Well, thanks for joining me. I want to remind folks, email lakedetective@gmail.com if you got a question for Steve. But good luck the rest of the summer, Steve.
Thank you so much, Rob. We'll be in touch.
That's our buddy Steve McComas, the Lake Detective out of St. Paul, Minnesota, Blue Water Science. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
It's Charles Barkley here with Wayfair. And let me tell you, game day is serious business at my house. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grill accessories, Wayfair's got it all. And it shows up fast. I'm talking fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game. And head to Wayfair.com to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Messy fans, Lowe's Messy Halftime Event hits July 19th. That's coming up fast, so now's a really good time to become a MyLowe's Rewards or a MyLowe's Pro Rewards member. Join for free and get access to exclusive Messy moments and epic surprises. Let's just say halftime's looking different this year. Make sure to follow Lowe's on TikTok and tune in to the Lowe's Messy Halftime Event on July 19th. Members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
This summer, I'm taking a new approach to styling the smallest spaces in my house with help from Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has the small space solutions that America's waited 250 years for, like retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, dinner party ready dining sets in 4 fun colors, stylish, spacious, Bobopedic sofas, and feature packed power recliners that let me kick back in even the smallest rooms. Plus, I know that Bob's styles are backed by thousands of real 5-star customer reviews, so I can trust that the furniture that I'm getting is not just affordable, but built to last. And the best part? Bob's Furniture ships fast, so I can enjoy my new styles all summer long. So when you're ready to ditch the furniture you're not excited about for the latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Rheotheca 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus rex. And Rheotheca 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Disney refreshing!
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, June 14th. I've got a great guest joining me here in just a minute. Kurt DeBerg is going to talk about an inscribed edition of The Old Man and the Sea, signed by Ernest Hemingway himself, that was found down in Rochester that he brought to the Nobel Prize Museum in Stockholm, Sweden. I'm a big Ernest Hemingway fan, so I'm excited to talk to Kurt about his experience. Now, before we do that, I don't plug a lot of events, but when they involve the Boundary Waters and a friend of mine named Dave Simonette, I want to give it a little publicity. On Thursday, July 9th, there's an event called Singing Into Wilderness, a special live benefit show for the Boundary Waters. Dave Simonette and friends with special guest Doug Duren will perform at the Hook and Ladder Event Center. That's in Minneapolis at 3010 Minnehaha Avenue. Live music, food trucks, an auction, and all the proceeds go to help sportsmen for the Boundary Waters. We've had Lucas Leaf and Matt Schultz, who used to be with that organization, on the show a number of times. Get tickets, learn more information at sportsmanbwca.org. Dave has done a ton for conservation over the years with multiple organizations. He's a fantastic musician, and we're so lucky that he is willing to volunteer his time to raise money for great causes. So I'm looking forward to trying to get to that event myself one more time, July 9th, Hook and Ladder Events Center in Minneapolis. Learn more at sportsmanbwca.org. All right, now on to our next guest, an interview I am really excited about. If you listen to the show, you know I'm a big fan of Ernest Hemingway's writing. And this guy who's joining us now is even more into it. His name is Curtis DeBerg. He's written several books about Hemingway and his travels and his life. And Kurt made a great discovery here in southeastern Minnesota a couple of years ago, and it unfolded more here in 2026. And he joins us now to talk about that. Mr. DeBerg, thanks so much for joining us. You're a retired professor and now an author who is interested in all things Ernest Hemingway. Is that a good summary of who you are?
That sure is. And Rob, thanks for having me on your show again. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, you've written several books about Ernest Hemingway, one about his travels, right? You kind of followed some of his pathways around the world and wrote about it.
Yeah, my first book was called Traveling the World with Hemingway. I didn't plan to write a travel coffee table book, but my publisher said, Kurt, since you're going to all these places that Hemingway lived and wrote and fished and hunted, why don't you take some really good pictures along the way and kind of keep a travel diary in a journal? And let's come out with a coffee table book. And then later on, you can do your biography or memoir later, which I ultimately wrote as my second book called Wrestling with Demons in Search of the Real Ernest Hemingway.
And you've got another book coming out, 3 Stories and 10 Poems. Well, the title is an ode to Hemingway's, one of the first things he's published. And that's what this book is. This is your own writing, but it is an ode to Hemingway.
Yes, it's a tribute to Hemingway. And it also mirrors Hemingway's very first book, which he published in 1923 when he was living in Paris with his first wife, Hadley. People that know Hemingway know that Hemingway lost most of his manuscripts when his wife was going to bring this valise to Lausanne, Switzerland. And she got off the train before it took off to get a glass of water and smoke a cigarette. And she got back and the suitcase was gone. And so were all of Ernest's manuscripts.
Most of what he'd written to that time. Yeah, that's a big footnote. And it's not a footnote. It's a big aspect to Hemingway's early life. Well, let's talk about this Minnesota connection. I believe this all started while you were researching your traveling Hemingway book, correct? You met a Franciscan nun down in Rochester, Minnesota, who had a Hemingway connection. Tell us how that unfolded.
Yes. Actually, I had already published my first Traveling the World with Hemingway book, and I was doing research, and I was in the final stages of researching my second book, and I dropped into the Mayo Clinic Hospital, which is known as the St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, just to see if there might be any archivists or if there might be some people there that might have known Hemingway back when he was there in 1960 and 1961, when he was being treated for psychosis.
Right before he committed suicide, literally.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was escorted into this majestic office, and sitting behind the desk was this 99-year-old pint of a woman. She couldn't have weighed more than 95 pounds. And she said, yes, I knew Hemingway and I'd love to talk to you about it. So I interviewed her for maybe 15 minutes. And before I left, I asked almost in passing, Lauren, did Hemingway leave anything with you as a memento? And she smiled at me and she said, as a matter of fact, he left me an inscribed copy of The Old Man and the Big Fish.
So we're going to give 99-year-old Lauren a little bit of a pass on getting that title wrong. She was talking about The Old Man and the Sea. But she presented this copy to you, and these were some of the last words Ernest Hemingway ever wrote, was the inscription in this book to Sister Lauren, huh?
Yes. The last known written words up till this point were dated on June 15, 1961, in a letter that Hemingway handwrote to his doctor's son, who happened to be in the hospital at the time. So when Sister Lauren presented this inscribed copy to one of her colleagues, it actually wasn't to her. The inscribed copy was to Sister Immaculata. And when I opened it up and I read the inscription, it was dated June 16. And of course, that jumped out at me. But just as important, Rob, was the inscription itself when it said, to Sister Lauren, this book for you when my writing luck is running good again, and it will. And he underlined, and it will.
That's amazing. I mean, there's some optimism there. And you mentioned the letter he wrote to that young man who I think was in the hospital in Denver at the time. I've read a bunch of Hemingway biographies, and it wasn't until I got to the end of the Carlos Baker one. That was, for whatever reason, the last one I read. I think it's on page 714 of a 716-page biography that they mention that letter to that young man, which is of interest to me. He talks about the hunting and the fishing opportunities in the Mississippi River Basin, not far from Rochester, which is where I grew up. Curtis, which is really, when I read that, I almost got emotional. It's like I'd read all this history about Hemingway, and here in these final two pages is his connection to where I grew up. And nonetheless, you found something that was written even later, and I love the spirit of optimism that's there, that he intended to keep writing.
You know, people have asked me, what do I think of that inscription? And on the one hand, I think it connotes a feeling of hope for Hemingway. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there's a contrary view which says it was part of his ruse to get the doctors to dismiss him. Yeah. And he wanted people to believe that he was psychologically well enough to leave the Mayo Clinic. And of course, he committed suicide on June 2nd or July 2nd, just 2 weeks later in Ketchum, Idaho.
Yeah, and there's a whole story there too. How was he able to access the shotgun, et cetera, et cetera. But
yeah.
This is, again, WCCO Outdoors. We're chatting with Curtis DeBerg. He's an author and retired professor.
He's got a new book coming out called Ode to Hemingway, 3 Stories and 10 Poems. We're talking about a book he found down in Rochester, believed to contain the last words Hemingway ever wrote to someone, an inscription to Sister Lauren, one of the Franciscan nuns down there. Okay, so you found the book. What has unfolded since then? Sister Lauren decided to donate it? Is that correct?
It was a remarkable story. Unfortunately, Sister Lauren died a couple years after I had met her in 2021. And I had remembered that the lady I had communicated with in order to get some photos of the book, her name was Sister Marissa. And so last summer, I was taking a holiday to Sweden, and I was in Stockholm. And in our last day there, my cousin and I dropped into the Nobel Prize Museum. The lady giving us the tour at the very end, I said, I've seen these things by Einstein and other Nobel laureates. I'm curious, why don't you have anything about Hemingway? And she said, oh, if only. We'd love to have something by Hemingway. Wow, and I said, I just happen to know where his final inscribed words are, but it's a long shot. But if you don't mind, I would contact the Franciscan sisters in Rochester. So I sent an email to Sister Marissa, and I put her in touch with the people at the museum. And a couple weeks later, Marissa came back and said, our board of directors has decided it's time for this book to come out of our vault, and we would love to have it be donated to the Nobel Prize Museum, and we would like you to deliver it for us, Curtis.
Wow, what an incredible opportunity and experience for you, Curtis. And you know, we should point out, Ernest Hemingway was one of, what, about a half dozen, or maybe there's a few more American Nobel Literature laureates. You know, that's the link to Sweden and the Nobel Museum. And the link to outdoors, which we're talking about here, is I, in some ways, consider Ernest Hemingway one of the first outdoors writers. He wrote The Big Two-Hearted about trout fishing in northern Michigan. He had The Old Man and the Sea is a great fishing story. It's a lot of different things, but it's a great fishing story. So that's the link to the conversation we're having here. So you then delivered this book to the Nobel Museum earlier this year, correct?
Yes, on January 23rd, I was invited to attend a ceremony that they had arranged. They had an actor read a passage from The Old Man and the Sea. There were probably 80 or 90 people in the audience at the museum. I was on the dais being interviewed by the PR director for the museum, and I think the interview lasted maybe 40 or 45 minutes. There was wine before, there was wine after, and of course, I was on cloud nine to be standing in a place that Hemingway wished he could have been standing in 1954. Right. But he was too ill.
He did not go to the ceremony. Yeah, he did not go to the ceremony. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would remind folks that you're fairly active with the International Hemingway Society. Every 2 years, they have a conference somewhere. It was in Spain, I believe, 2 years ago. This year, it's in Toronto, Canada. Yep. The conference usually goes to places where Hemingway, you know, had some connections, and he was in Toronto as a young reporter. I believe Jack Bumby was born in Toronto, if memory serves.
You should attend this conference. You've got the chops.
I know. But the Hemingway conference for 2026 will be there, and you're going to present a seminar about what you and I just talked about.
Yes, I'm on a panel with two others, and I'm not exactly sure what the topic, but somehow mine falls under new discoveries of Hemingway even to this day. And so I will be on that panel. And then later on, I'm moderating a panel about Hemingway in the movies. I don't know how I got chosen for this. I have written a screenplay that I'm shopping around to production companies now called The Hemingway Code. So the only way I can figure out I got assigned to be a moderator to this is because somebody found out I've been working on a screenplay.
Well, thank you for sharing this story with us, Curtis. If folks want to read more about your writing, if they want to find your books, obviously Amazon. Do you have a website you'd like to mention also?
Yes. My name is Curt DeBerg at C-U-R-T, and DeBerg is DeBerg.com. You can go there to find all the information you want about the Nobel Prize Museum story, my forthcoming book. Please have a visit and have a look around.
KurtDeBerg.com. And then also, if anyone's interested in that International Hemingway Conference, it's July 20th to 25th in Toronto. Just Google Hemingway Society. You can learn all about that and all about that great organization. I'm a member of it myself. I enjoy their twice a year. They deliver a little booklet with all the latest Hemingway research and writing. And it's great fun if you're a Hemingway geek like I am.
That's great, Rob. Thank you for having me today.
Kurt, thanks for joining us. Safe travels to you. And it's good to see you again, my friend.
Thank you.
Curt DeBerg. Check out his website, KurtDeBerg.com. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast. Final segment of this week's program on this Sunday, June 14th. Thank you to my guests. Thank you to all the listeners who have joined us for the past 1 hour. A couple topics I wanted to discuss before we say goodbye for another week. First off, I went fishing last weekend. Got out on the water on the Mississippi River. I don't want to be any more specific than that because we had pretty good fishing. We got into some big pike. I was out with my two younger sons and my daughter. It was take a kid fishing weekend. Saw a lot of other boats out, usually with single men in them. They mostly look like bass guys. I did not see any other kids on the water, even though my kids they're getting older. My boys are in their early 20s and my daughter's a mid-teen. So she was the only one who could technically take advantage of take a kid fishing weekend. Although, as we've discussed last weekend, everybody could fish for free in the state because the ELS system was transitioning to the new system, which kicked off this past Tuesday. I talked about that at the start of the show.
But we caught, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen pretty nice pike down there to the point where I was like, what's going on with northerns in the Mississippi? So I called Nick Schlesser with the Minnesota DNR. He's out of Lake City. He's the area manager. And I asked him that question point blank. And he said, these are good times for northern pike on the Mississippi. He said, the overall population level, the number of fish out there is, you know, about average, maybe a little above average. But he said the number of trophy pike on the river is at an all-time high. And he credited that to a 1/30-inch regulation. There's a 3-fish bag, 1/30 allowed in the Mississippi, the border waters there with Wisconsin. I believe he said that rule's been in place since 2020. And I'm telling you, folks, it's paying off. There's a lot of nice pike in the Mississippi. I'm glad you can only keep 1/30. We had a fish take a spoon really deep in the gut. One of those situations where you pulled it out, you could just tell that fish was in rough shape. We said, all right, let's bring one home for dinner. And we did. My boys filleted out the Y-bones. We did a surf and turf night with my parents, and we all had a hearty helping of northern pike, which is a fine eating fish. I almost hate to remind people that, because I think having big pike out there is important. They help manage other fish. But Schlesser pointing out that they don't really deal with the hammer handle phenomenon on the river. You know, it's such a fertile system. There's so much forage, the gizzard shad, other forage species out there, that the pike just kind of cruise right through that hammer handle stage. So unlike so many of our lakes where we got all these little hammer handle pike that no one wants to fillet, there's some nice pike swimming the Mississippi. And again, they're a fun species to catch, and I think they're an underrated fish in the pan. So I wrote my column about that, had some good pike fishing last weekend. And then before we go, we got the results of the turkey hunting seasons, the spring seasons in Minnesota and Wisconsin. They were both down from last year, and I don't think that's a surprise. Minnesota's harvest was down about 10% from a year ago, but still the third highest kill on record. We took 15,245 birds here during the spring season that ended at the end of May. That was down about 1,600 birds from last year, which was an all-time record. The DNR not worried about turkey numbers at all. Hey, it was still a top three harvest. You can hit a record every year. I think anybody who spends time running around Minnesota's outdoors sees a lot of turkeys and know they're doing pretty well here, even though not so good in other states down south. Wisconsin had another great year. The harvest down there also, but not as much as Minnesota's, down 5%. From a year ago, although the press release from the Wisconsin DNR went out of its way to say still 8% above the 5-year average. God forbid we actually point out that the harvest was down 1 year over there in the Badger State. But Wisconsin hunters taking almost 48,000 birds this year, again down from a little over 50,000 in 2025. And man, when you stop and pause, that's an incredible number. That's more than triple the number of turkeys we take here in Minnesota. Wisconsin, a state that is smaller in terms of total square miles than Minnesota, but they know how to grow turkeys over there. go figure. With that, everybody, have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Dreisline. I'll be back with you in 7 days. This has been WCCO Outdoors.
Messy fans, Lowe's Messy Halftime Event hits July 19th. That's coming up fast, so now's a really good time to become a MyLowe's Rewards or a MyLowe's Pro Rewards member. Join for free and get access to exclusive Messy moments and epic surprises. Let's just say halftime's looking different this year. Make sure to follow Lowe's on TikTok and tune in to the Lowe's Messy Halftime Event on July 19th. Members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snapple, it's refreshing!
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
We the people of the ballpark are all in on baseball. We deserve dingers and dogs, sunshine and a beat, a place to take it all in and let it all out. Baseball for the people. Baseball is something else. Visit MLB.com/tickets and spend this summer with us. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from PUC examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.